Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adam Shapiro, co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, who contrasts the inevitable silence of the dead in Gaza and the chosen silence of those who deliberately do not speak out against oppression. Itzhak Ben-Mocha, an Israeli Army reservist who explains why he refuses to fight in Israel's current military offensive in Gaza, and retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who discusses the merits of President-elect Barack Obama's choice of former Clinton Chief of Staff Leon Panetta to become the next director of the CIA. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports opposition is growing against a plan in Rio de Janeiro to build a 10-foot-high wall surrounding the notorious Dona Marta slum. The state governor of Rio, Sergio Cabral, says the goal of the 10-foot-high eco-barrier is to prevent illegal settlement in the nearby Atlantic rainforest and to combat drug trafficking and ruthless gangs. Human rights critics say the huge barrier will create social apartheid in Rio. Mauricio Campo of the group Network of Communities Against Violence asserted that the wall is very similar to what Israel does to the Palestinians and to what happened in South Africa. Since November, Dona Marta has been under 24-hour police occupation in a campaign to make the neighborhood a model favela or slum, featuring a major reinvestment program to build new housing and install a wireless internet network. The state of Rio has also pledged to increase the local standard of living and break the grip of street gangs in this sprawling low-income neighborhood. Over the last 6 months, the Bush administration has targeted federal agency whistleblowers and fired career-level staff who dissented from administration policy. According to the magazine In These Times, the fired whistleblowers worked in the Department of Commerce, Labor, Education, and Transportation. Jesslyn Raddick of the Watchdog Government Accountability Project notes the Bush attack on whistleblowers began after Bush signed the No Fear Act in 2002. She called it a brutal campaign of retaliation against anybody who dissents, disagrees, or exercises independent judgment. Marcia Coleman Adebayo, head of the National Whistleblowers Center, was also a policy analyst at the Environmental Protection Agency. In the face of EPA inaction during the Clinton administration, she disclosed that a U.S.-based company exposed its own workers to toxic waste in South Africa. She then faced months of racial and sexual harassment. In 2000, Coleman Adebayo was awarded $600,000 in damages from the EPA, the most ever levied against the environmental agency. Coleman Adebayo is now fighting her recent termination by the EPA for an alleged medical inability to perform her job. A furor arose among gay activists in April 2007 when Democrats in Congress dropped protections for transgender people from a pending employment non-discrimination bill known as ENDA, which accords gays and lesbians rights against job discrimination. Despite 30,000 emails from activists, Democrats took the transgender language out of the bill. ENDA then passed the House of Representatives with a 235 to 184 margin. The Human Rights Campaign was the only national gay rights group to support the watered-down bill. In spite of criticism from other activists, HRC called the final bill a significant step forward. According to the American Prospect magazine, there is a long history of compromise of transgender rights in the push for gay rights. The first gay rights bill in San Francisco stalled in 1977 when advocates under pressure to compromise excluded cross-dressers, transsexuals, and other transgender people from the legislation. The same exclusion was used by states in the 1990s as state-level gay rights bills began to become law. In the 1990s, transgender activists started to become a political force of their own, and gender identity began to be added to city and state anti-discrimination laws. In 2009, the Connecticut legislature will debate a bill on transgender rights. Connecticut was the third state in the nation to recognize same-sex marriage, behind Massachusetts and California. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Israel's attack on Gaza, which it says is necessary in order to stop the ruling Hamas party from firing rockets into southern Israel, has resulted in a humanitarian disaster. As of January 13th, UN and medical personnel on the ground in Gaza estimate that over 900 Palestinians have been killed, with as many as half being civilians, including hundreds of women and children. 4,000 Gazans are reported injured. Israel has suffered 13 deaths, including 10 soldiers. The protests against Israel's air bombardment, which began December 27th, and ground invasion, which was launched on January 3rd, have been growing in size and number. Last weekend, protests were held in at least 114 American cities in 40 states and in many other cities around the world. In New Haven, Connecticut, about 200 people gathered for an indoor rally to hear a Palestinian-American, African-American Muslim, and Palestinian speakers denounce Israel. They called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza as a short-term goal and an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands as a necessary step to reach a peaceful, lasting settlement. One of the speakers at the rally was Adam Shapiro, an American Jew married to a Palestinian American, who together helped co-found the International Solidarity Movement. The ISM conducts nonviolent direct action in Palestinian lands to demand an end to the occupation. Two of their members, Rachel Corey and Tom Herndl, were killed by Israeli soldiers while committing acts of civil disobedience. In this excerpt of his talk, recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, Shapiro contrasts the silence of the dead in Gaza and the silence of those who refused to speak out against oppression.
So I started thinking about this idea of silence and the implications of it, right? And silence is very much connected to trying to obscure something, trying to keep something hidden. And this is what we're finding from the Israeli side, and what we have found from the Israeli side, even though it is the Israelis and their supporters around the world who will always step up and make sure and utilize the experience of history, most notably the Holocaust, as a reason not to forget and to speak out about whatever current victimization they can create and press people with, a sense of victimization. And I think now what we're seeing is the unveiling for the first time before American eyes and before the mainstream media, people are not buying it, right? Because when you go and you see a woman who's traumatized in Sderot, and not that I think she should be traumatized, but her trauma about a rocket that hit in a field somewhere nearby does not in any way compare to the silence of the dead that are piling up in Gaza. I agree with Tzvi Lipni, by the way. This is not a humanitarian crisis. There is a humanitarian disaster happening to the Palestinian people. But the crisis is a political man-made crisis, not a humanitarian crisis. And we should not think for a moment that just by pouring in aid and relief and development, that this is the way to help the Gazans or the Palestinian people. What Palestinians need, what we need to do, is politics. And we should not shy away from that anymore. We should not couch our politics or try to obscure them in some way to make them more palatable in terms of humanitarian concerns. Unfortunately, it's true, as Nada said, actually, it's a very good point, that in the Jewish community there are starting to be people speaking up and questioning. But too often among that community, and too often the way people feel comfortable talking about this, is that we need to stop this because of the humanitarian disaster that's happening. No, we need to stop this because Gaza is not free. We need to stop this because it is occupation. We need to stop this because it is a true crime. The Red Cross, its statement today about attacking the truck and not having access to the bodies to recover them and the injured, they pointed out that this was Israel's violation of international humanitarian law. Indeed, it is a violation of international humanitarian law. Unfortunately, under international humanitarian law, Israel can go and kill Palestinians. That's legal according to international law. Not civilians. They can't target civilians. But, you know, as long as they're, you know, targeting somebody called Hamas somewhere, right? International law gives them a pass. We need to challenge even international law. It's not enough anymore to stand up on international law. Nobody's listening to it anyway. We need to say clearly once and for all, there is no Palestinian, nowhere, who deserves or who is warranted to be killed by anybody, and certainly not by Israel. I think we're doing an amazing job. I see pictures and reports from all over the world, from big cities and small towns. My friend, who is a Jewish American, who is totally opposed to the Zionist regime, he heard that there was a pro-Israel gathering at some point in Washington, D.C. this week. He went out by himself with a sign challenging this rally. I think people are finding the courage. He would never have done that a year ago, 2 years ago. I think people are finding the courage to go and do such things. I think this is unprecedented, and I think it's amazing, and I think we need to keep it up. But let's remember this. What I would ask is that we not just keep it up for as long as the bombs are falling in Gaza. I've never come to hate a word like I hate the word ceasefire now. We need to keep this up. We need to keep up this pressure, because the goal is not ceasefire. The goal is not stopping the bombs from dropping that Israel is dropping on Gaza. The goal is an end to the occupation. And that requires all of us. That requires all of us to keep up our vigilance and to keep up our work. And even when the occupation is finished, and in this case I will use the analogy with apartheid, right? Our work, you know, against apartheid was not finished when the law was changed and there was no more apartheid in South Africa. The work in South Africa today continues for justice, continues for rights for all people, because it's not just simply about ending an oppressive system, it's also about achieving justice. And so we must remember that also the occupation is the same. We must end it, but we must also continue to fight for all the rights of all Palestinians, the rights to return, the rights to their homes, the rights to every right that a Palestinian should have.
That was Adam Shapiro of the International Solidarity Movement. Visit the group's website at palsolidarity.org. Shapiro recently released a 6-part DVD about the history of Palestinians since 1948 that he helped produce, called Chronicles of a Refugee. Find more information at chroniclesofarefugee.org. The vast majority of Israelis support their government's current war on Gaza, believing it's the only way to stop rocket attacks coming from the Hamas-led territory. And no doubt, many also hope the Israeli military can eliminate Hamas as a threat once and for all. But there is a smaller group of Israelis who oppose their country's action, and some are found within the Israeli military, called the Israeli Defense Force, which Palestinians call the Israeli Occupation Force. Yitzhak Ben Mocha is one of a number of reservists who have refused to serve in Gaza. Now a 25-year-old student, he joined the IDF at 18, like most Israelis do. He served 3 years in an elite paratrooper unit, much of it in the West Bank. While in the West Bank, he observed soldiers using civilians as human shields, beating Palestinians, and destroying private property, including homes and olive groves. He came to the conclusion that the conflict with the Palestinians would not end until Israel ends their occupation of Palestinian land. Ben Mocha is still a reservist in the Israeli military, but when he was called up to serve in the ongoing conflict in Gaza, he refused. Although the government is putting some refusers on trial, Ben Mocha has not yet been prosecuted, but told he may be called up again, in which case he again plans to refuse. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus reached Ben Mocha by phone in Israel and asked him to explain why he is refusing to fight in Gaza.
I know there is more people like me which refused in the last weeks to be part of the fighting, and the army just released them from the army service. It did not judge them as it judged refusal years before. And that because we think it's because he understands that if he put them in jail, it gives them much more power. And the media are interested with them, doing article on them, and give them a much, much louder voice. And the army do not want that. You want to create a reality which, an image of the reality which all the combat soldiers are united and believe in the idea of the war, some is the society. You want to make a picture of ideal belief in that fighting.
Yitzhak Ben Mocha, you wrote in your essay about your refusal, quote, "For over 40 years, society and leadership of the State of Israel have avoided formulating a clear and unambiguous resolution regarding the destiny of the Palestinian people and the future of the occupied territories. As a result, they send their sons to become soldiers and occupants and oppressors. Yet it seems like among the young generations in Israel, the understanding grows that this is not another, quote, we had no choice, unquote, war. Not like the wars in the stories which we were brought up on. They understand that there are better ways to resolve the conflict, and they understand that ultimately violent measures will only take us back to the same point again and again." So how much change do you see among young people who are unwilling to serve in the Israeli army, or, you know, how do you determine that change?
20 years ago and even before that, it seems like there was a very, very isolated people who refused to serve in the military service from conscientious idea. And nowadays, as long as the occupation continues, the numbers are going up. I cannot say it's most of the Israel society, definitely not, and it's not a very large numbers, but they are definitely growing up. And we're talking about more people in age of 18 who, from the beginning, refusing to go to the army service, to be part of it. And they have much, much better way to quit of the army if they're afraid or if they just want to do other things. But they prefer to state and say very clearly the clearance that they are refusing from the reason they don't want to be a part of the occupation, and they sent to jail for years, and so on, about the number of reserve soldiers who are refusing to be a part of the occupation, and those numbers are growing up also, maybe not as big as we wanted them to be, but definitely growing up. As I wrote, it seems like it beginning of understanding. And you should understand that for anybody that refusing to serve in the army, there is much more people disagree with the occupation but still want to save democratic rule place. And that's why they don't refuse.
What would you most like Americans to know about what motivates your refusal to serve in the Israeli army except for training purposes?
Israel has the right to defend herself, and we definitely want a defense from the Hamas rocket. But we should see this war not as a defense from the Hamas, but part of the much larger view of the occupation. We cannot separate this war from the occupation. It's one thing. And until the occupation wouldn't stop, the war continues. It's hard for me to make myself clear in English. Maybe it's a better idea to say to the American audience another thing, like the media in Israel maybe don't want you to hear about that, but there is another voice in the Israel society and between the Israeli soldiers. That's the voice of peace, and that's the voice of non-violence, and that's the voice we are saying, that's our voice, and it's making a picture of a more courage society in Israel, more sane society in Israel, and we are seeing such a image of the, and such a voice, we hear in such a voice, similar voice from the Palestinian society also in the last years. I think that's the important thing that the American nation should hear.
That was Israeli military refuser Yitzhak Ben Mocha. For more information on Israeli soldiers refusing to serve in Gaza, visit the website courageToRefuse.org. President-elect Barack Obama's selection of former California Congressman and Clinton White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta to become the nation's next director of the CIA came as a surprise to many in Washington. Panetta, a former director of the Office of Management and Budget, who currently directs with his wife the Leon and Sylvia Panetta Institute for Public Policy in California, has no experience working within U.S. intelligence agencies. Outgoing Senate Intelligence Committee Chair, West Virginia Democrat John D. Rockefeller IV, and incoming Intelligence Chair, California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, were both initially critical of the Panetta nomination, favoring an intelligence professional for the post. Although Feinstein has since supported the Panetta pick, both she and Rockefeller have themselves been criticized as being submissive and/or complicit with the Bush administration's warrantless wiretap program and White House-authorized torture of U.S.-held detainees. But some veterans of the CIA view Panetta as a good choice for his overall integrity and past record of opposition to U.S.-sponsored torture and extraordinary rendition of terrorist suspects. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who until his retirement in 1990 led one of two CIA teams conducting the most secret daily intelligence briefings at the White House. McGovern discusses the merits of the Panetta CIA nomination and the importance of holding Bush administration officials, including the president himself, accountable for violations of the Geneva Conventions and U.S. law in authorizing the abuse of prisoners.
Leon Panetta, he's not a person who was involved in the abuses of the last 8 years. You know, when I say abuses, that's really a euphemism. What we're talking about is war crimes, okay? Talking about torture, talking about kidnapping people, some people off the streets of Milan, Italy, sending them to Egypt or elsewhere to be tortured. These are all violations not only of international law, but of domestic law. There's a War Crimes Act passed by the Republican-dominated Congress in 1996, which prohibits explicitly all these things and has very severe penalties, including the death penalty for those who are responsible for prisoners dying on their watch. And as you probably know, there have been several prisoners, over 100, that have died. So Leon Panetta has nothing to do with that. And it's sort of strange that that should be the most welcome qualification, because there are several others. But that's really important, because he has no reason to cover up what's been going on. He has no reason to try to defend it. Now, Panetta is the kind of person that I have always felt, and that I worked under 9 directors of the CIA during my 27 years as a CIA analyst. Panetta is the kind of person who's sort of a self-made man. You know, he doesn't have to prove anything. He's got a distinguished career in Congress as White House Chief of Staff. Originally, he was a Republican. Most people don't know that. He's a Republican. He worked in the Nixon administration in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. He was heading up this Civil Rights Division, which was aimed at redressing some of the evils of the past in terms of, you know, segregation and things like that. And when Nixon decided on his Southern strategy, he didn't have any use for this civil rights stuff, and he told Panetta to knock it off. And Panetta said, "Hey, man, I came to work here for civil rights. I'm going to keep going." And they agreed to disagree, and Panetta quit. So that's the kind of guy he is.
Ray McGovern, among the critics of Leon Panetta as the new director of the CIA, were two key Democrats in the Senate Intelligence Committee: the outgoing chair, West Virginia Democrat Jay Rockefeller, and incoming Senate Intelligence Chair, California Democrat Dianne Feinstein. Both expressed concern that Panetta lacked experience and advocated that an intelligence professional take the post as opposed to Panetta. Feinstein has sort of backed off that and has come around to support Panetta in the last few days. What do you make of Rockefeller and Feinstein and their initial criticism of Panetta? Do they need to hide something in terms of their collaboration with the Bush administration and the wiretapping and torture and extraordinary rendition over the last bunch of years?
They sure do, Scott, if you put your finger on the pulse here. In short, Scott, the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee really deserves the label Senate Intelligence Overlook Committee. condition, the sending people off kidnapped to other countries. They overlook the black holes where they're still keeping people like that, waterboarding, the whole schmear. And Nancy Pelosi, she was informed about this too, you know?
Barack Obama has recently said in a TV news interview on ABC that he wanted to look forward and not backward, leading many to believe that he would not press for accountability or prosecution of those in the Bush administration, including President Bush himself, for what they clearly ordered in terms of abuse of their power and abuse of prisoners, including waterboarding and other forms of torture. How important is it that people in the Bush administration are held to account?
Well, I think it's very important. And there are two ways to do this, basically. One is to appoint a special prosecutor or independent prosecutor and have him really go at what's been going on, subpoena power and everything else. And the other is to appoint an independent commission that would take a longer view, look at it in an investigatory way, looking at all the, and tell, you know, educate the American people as they go along. And that would take maybe 2 years or so before anybody's brought to accountability. I favor the first, but people who know a lot more about these things tell me that the second is a more considered way to go, a safer way. You really have to educate American people because they're just not ready. Still, they're just not ready to believe that their president, vice president, are war criminals. I mean, it's just too much to handle. And the reason they can't believe it is because of what I call the fawning corporate media, the FCM, okay? The fawning corporate media do not let the American people know what's going on.
That was 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Read McGovern's article, Obama Picks a Conscience for the CIA, at consortiumnews.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.